Chapter 16. Indian Ocean. Okay, shut her down, Sam called. Remy turned off the ignition key and the Dow's engines sputtered out. Sam hoisted the sails and they held their collective breaths for a few seconds until the canvas caught the wind and billowed out. The Dow's bow lifted slightly and the boat lurched forward. Sam crab-walked aft and dropped onto the afterdeck beside Remy. We have liftoff, Sam said. Here's hoping we don't have to call Houston with a problem, Remy said, and handed him a bottle of water. It was already mid-afternoon, and they were only 5 miles north of Mafia Island. While Remy's discerning eye had noticed the propeller shaft's bearing problem, it hadn't been until Sam had gotten it apart that they realized how much time the repair would require. As Remy supervised the boys in finishing up the maintenance and changing out the sails, Sam and Ed worked under the shade of a makeshift sheet awning. Once done, Buziba and another dozen boys appeared and carried the Dow down to the waterline, where they tested the engine and took the Dow for a test drive around the harbor. An hour later, the Dow fully stocked with water, supplies, and food, Sam and Remy waved to Buziba and Ed and set out.
How long until we get there? Remy asked.
Sam got up, retrieved the chart they'd found inside the cabin, and unfolded it in his lap. He checked the readout of his handheld GPS unit and plotted their position. Another 39 miles. We're doing about 5 knots. If we run all night, we'll get there shortly after midnight. Or we could find some place to lie up tonight, then set out early and get there about dawn. There's an unnamed island about 12 miles north of Fanjove.
That's my vote. Without radar, we're asking for trouble.
Agreed. We wouldn't be able to see anything of Sukuti until daylight anyway. They sailed north for another 5 hours, caught a tailwind for the last hour, and found the island just as the upper rim of the sun was dipping behind the horizon. Sam steered the dhow into a small cove and dropped anchor. Once the boat was secure, Remy ducked into the cabin for a few minutes, emerging with a lantern, a camping stove, and 2 cans of food.
What can I serve you, El Capitan? Baked beans or baked beans and franks?
Sam pursed his lips.
Choices, choices.
Let's celebrate our not sinking. Let's have both.
A fine choice.
And for dessert, fresh mango. The surprisingly comfortable double army cot, combined with the salt air and the gentle rocking of the dhow at anchor, lulled them into a deep, restful sleep. At 4 a.m., Sam's watch chimed and they got up and moving, sharing a breakfast of leftover mango and strong black coffee before weighing anchor and setting out again. They lost an hour of progress to sluggish pre-dawn winds, but shortly before sunrise the air picked up and before long they were clipping north at a steady 6 knots that brought them within sight of North Fanjove Island by 7 a.m. A half hour later they drew even with the atoll Mitchell had pointed out. Here they secured the sails, switched to engine power, and spent another nerve-wracking 40 minutes picking their way through the reefs until they reached the south side of Little Sukuti Island. Sam tooled along the coast until Remy spotted a mangrove-choked cove they hoped would shield the dhow from prying eyes. Following Remy's hand signals from the bow, Sam steered into the cove. He shut off the engine and let the dhow drift forward until the bow gently wedged itself between 2 mangroves jutting diagonally from the bank. Having listened to the steady putt-putt-putt of the dhow's engine for the last hour, the sudden silence was jarring. They stood still for half a minute, listening, until the jungle around them slowly came back to life with a cacophony of squawks and buzzes. Remy secured the bow line to one of the tree trunks, then headed aft to join Sam on the afterdeck.
"What's the plan?" she asked.
"We're assuming the Belle is still aboard the Njiwa. That's the best-case scenario. With any luck, we won't have to set foot on the island itself. Either way, we have to wait for nightfall. For now, I say we do a little reconnaissance and have a little picnic."
"Reconnaissance and a picnic," Remy repeated with a smile. "Every woman's dream date."
Unlike its larger alter ego, Little Sakuti Island was all mangrove swamp and jungle, save a lone jagged peak that, on the vertical, was no more than 500 feet above the ocean's surface. But, as Sam and Remy had learned many times, a 500-foot ascent on rough, winding trails could turn into a 3 or 4 hour hike. By 10 a.m., already sweating profusely and covered in bug bites and mud, they emerged from the swamp and pushed their way into the jungle. With Sam in the lead, they pushed north until they came across what they were looking for. A stream. Water meant animals, and animals meant game trails. It took them only a few minutes to find one heading northwest toward the island's summit. Shortly before 1 in the afternoon, they broke free of the jungle and found themselves at the foot of the escarpment. "That's a relief," Remy said, staring upward. The rock face was manageable, 50 feet tall, no steeper than 50 degrees, and with plenty of crags and cracks they could use for foot and handholds. After a short water break, they headed upward and were soon nestled in a little rock alcove beneath the peak. They each pulled a pair of binoculars from their packs, rose up, and looked around. "There she blows," Sam muttered. A mile away and 100 feet below them was Okafor's home. Painted a butter yellow with stark white trim, it sat in a near-perfect circular clearing of reddish-brown dirt. At this distance, they could make out details they'd missed from the air. As Sam had predicted, a trio of men in green coveralls were working along the eastern side of the grounds, two hacking at the encroaching foliage with machetes, the third mowing a strip of lawn. The villa itself was massive, easily 15,000 square feet, with wraparound balconies on each floor. At the rear of the property was what looked like a radio antenna, satellite TV tower. "Do you see that?" Remy asked. "What?" "On the roof, eastern corner." Sam pointed his binoculars where Remy had indicated and saw a pair of Big Eyes naval binoculars mounted on a tripod. "Well," Sam said, "the bad news is to the southwest they can see anything coming 10 miles away. You see the coaxial cable attached to the housing?"
"I see it."
"It's for remote control and monitoring, I'm guessing. Probably from a control room in the house. The good news is I don't think they're night vision capable." They continued panning their binoculars, moving down the slope to the helicopter pad. At the edge of the white stone perimeter, a lone man in khaki coveralls sat in a lawn chair. Leaning against his left thigh was an AK-74 assault rifle.
"He's asleep," Remy said.
"That, and the missing helicopter, tell us the boss is away." Sam panned his binoculars again. After a moment, he said, "I've got movement on the Injiwa."
"I see it," Remy replied. "There's a familiar face."
There was no mistaking Itzli Rivera's gaunt, ropey frame and sunken face. He stood on the yacht's foredeck, a satellite phone to his ear. After a minute of listening, he nodded, checked his watch, said something into the handset, and disconnected. He turned aft, cupped his hands to his mouth, and shouted something. 10 seconds later, Nochtli and Yaotl came jogging through the arch on the port side weather deck and stopped before Rivera, who spoke to them for a few minutes before they rushed off again. "Looked like Rivera was passing on some orders from on high. Let's hope it's about the bell."
"Our bell," Remy corrected him with a smile.
"I like the way you think. Let's do a guard count." They spent the next 15 minutes doing just this and came up with 4. 1 at the helicopter pad, 1 patrolling the road to the dock, and 2 strolling around the villa's perimeter. Unless they missed someone, it appeared no guards were watching the island's approaches. "We can't forget Rivera and the other 2 stooges, Sam said. "They're probably staying aboard the boat. If so, we might have to find a way to get them off."
"That won't be easy. Based on how much trouble they've gone to get the bell, they're probably sleeping beside it."
They spent the remainder of the afternoon drawing a detailed map of the island and enjoying their ersatz picnic of fruit, nuts, and bottled water. Shortly after 5, they heard a faint chopping sound to the east. They focused their binoculars, and soon enough the sound took the shape of a helicopter. Ambonisier Okafor's Eurocopter EC-135, jet black with tinted windows, swept over the island and did a slow circuit, as though the man aboard were surveying his kingdom before stopping in a hover over the pad and touching down. The guard on duty was already standing at attention, spine erect, and AK-74 held at port arms. As the rotors spooled down, the Eurocopter's side door opened and out stepped a tall, lean African man in a crisp white suit and mirrored sunglasses. "Fun's over," Sam said. "Dad's home." "Clearly our host went to the Idi Amin School of Fashion," Remy said. "I'd be willing to bet his closet is packed with clones of that outfit." Sam smiled behind his binoculars. "Then again, who's going to risk telling him he's a cliché?" Okafor strode across the pad and snapped off a salute to the guard. As he reached the path, an electric golf cart pulled to a stop before him. He climbed in, and the cart headed up the hill toward the villa. Sam said, "Now we'll see if Okafor's return stirs up any action." After another 10 minutes, the cart returned down the hill, turned onto the dock road, and stopped beside the Njiwa. Rivera strode down the gangplank and got into the passenger seat, and the cart returned to the villa, where Rivera disappeared inside. He emerged 20 minutes later, and the golf cart returned him to the Njiwa. Sam and Remy kept their focus on the yacht. 5 minutes passed, then 10, then 20. There was no movement on the decks, no reaction to Rivera's meeting with Okafor. "That was underwhelming," Remy said, looking sideways at Sam. "I can see the gears turning in your head. You have a plan of attack?" Over the years, Sam's and Remy's complementary personalities had molded the planning of the dicier parts of their adventures. Sam would develop the plan, and Remy would play devil's advocate, running the plan through her steel-trap mind until they decided it workable and would minimize the likelihood that they'd find themselves in over their heads. So far, the system had worked well, though the water frequently reached their chins. "Almost," Sam said. He lowered his binoculars and checked his watch. "We better start back down. It'll be nightfall in 4 hours." The return leg of the hike was easier going, partially because they weren't fighting gravity, and partially because they'd already blazed the trail. Back at sea level, they circumnavigated the mangrove swamp to the south, turned north again at the beach, then swam the last quarter mile. They were nearing the mouth of the cove when Remy stopped swimming and said, "Quiet. Listen." Sam heard it a few moments later, the faint rumble of a marine engine somewhere to their right. They turned and saw a Rinker speedboat coming around the headline 100 yards away. One man was behind the wheel. A second stood behind him, scanning the shoreline through a pair of binoculars. "Deep breath," Sam said to Remy. Together they gulped a lungful of air, then curled under the water and dove. 6 feet beneath the surface, they leveled off and began stroking toward the cove. Arm outstretched, Sam reached the bank a few seconds before Remy. He curled his fingers around the roots jutting from the mud, then turned, grabbed Remy's hand, and pulled her in. Sam pointed above their heads where a tangle of dead brush floated on the surface. Together they let themselves float up. They broke into the air and looked around. "You hear the engine?" Sam whispered in Remy's ear.
"No. Wait. There they are."
Sam looked in the direction of Remy's nod. Through the twigs he could see the Rinker sitting still in the water about 50 feet away. The engine coughed once, sputtered, then went dead. The driver tried again but got the same result. He pounded his fist on the wheel. His partner stepped to the stern, knelt down, and lifted the engine hatch.
"Engine trouble," Sam whispered. "They'll move on soon."
It was either that, they both knew, or these two would have to call for a tow, which meant Sam and Remy wouldn't be going anywhere for a while.
"Cross fingers," Remy replied.
Aboard the Rinker, the second man turned and said something to the driver, who tried the engine again. It coughed and died.
"Spark plug," Sam muttered.
In the corner of his eye, he saw Remy's head move, slowly leaning backward until her face was pointing upward. Sam slowly turned his head, looked at her, and followed her gaze. He found himself staring into a pair of beady brown eyes. Not 6 inches away, the eyes blinked once, then narrowed slightly. It took a moment for Sam to realize what he was seeing.
"Monkey," he whispered to Remy.
"Yes, Sam, I noticed."
"Capuchin?"
"Colobus, I think. Juvenile."
From the direction of the rinker, they heard the engine turn over again. This time it caught, sputtered, then settled into a steady idle. Above them, the colobus jerked its head up at the noise, its tiny hands clamping down on the branches. It looked back down at Sam and Remy. Remy cooed,
"Easy, little—"
The colobus opened its mouth and began shrieking and shaking the branches so wildly that leaves rained down on them. Sam lowered his head and peered through the brush pile. Aboard the rinker, both men were standing up, rifles at the shoulder, muzzles aimed in their direction. Suddenly, a crack. One of the muzzles flashed. The bullet zipped through the foliage above their heads. The colobus shrieked louder and flailed at the branches. Sam groped underwater, found Remy's hand, squeezed it. She whispered,
"Are they?"
"I don't think so. They're looking for lunch."
Crack! More shrieking and shaking. Silence. Sam could hear the colobus's hands and feet pattering away.
"They're turning our way," Sam whispered. "Get ready for a deep breath."
Through the brush, they watched as the rinker's bow came around until it was pointed directly at them. It began gliding forward, slowly closing the gap. The second man was now standing beside the driver, rifle braced on the windshield's frame.
"Wait," Sam rasped.
"Wait."
When the rinker was 15 feet away, he said,
"Deep breath. Under."
They submerged together, each one clawing for handholds as they dragged themselves back first down the bank. When their feet sunk into the mud, they craned their necks back. On the surface, the rinker's bow was shoving its way into the brush pile. Sam and Remy heard muffled voices, then the cracking of branches. Leaves fluttered down and dotted the surface. Finally, after nearly a minute, the rinker's propeller reversed and began churning. The boat began backing out. Sam and Remy waited until the bow swung around and the rinker began moving away before resurfacing. They caught their breath and watched as the boat disappeared around the bend.
"They didn't get him, did they?"
Remy asked. Sam turned and smiled at her. "That's my girl. Animal lover until the end. No, he got away. Come on. Let's get out of here."